And welcome back to another episode of Gopher Gridiron Radio. I am your host and publisher, Ryan Burns of GopherIllustrated.com. And unfortunately for you that love Luke Buehr today, he's not going to be here. Figured I owed him one based on the last episode where I didn't make it because of all the snafus at the Gopher Football Complex. And I missed out on a beautiful advanced analytics episode, all pertaining to football. So if you haven't already, go listen to that. But we're going to get into some nitty gritty today about Gopher football spring practice observations, the Big Ten West, as joining me is my partner in crime on the Gopher football beat, Mr. Daniel House, the founder of gophersguru.com. Daniel, I know we've had some issues this morning technology wise, but when you get to be my age of 29, everything just starts to go downhill for you. So how are you doing today?
Ryan Burns was like Joe Rossi adapting to the offensive scheme he wasn't expecting. Just on a dime, pivots to Zoom. It was an outstanding performance.
Yeah, so we're hoping this audio doesn't sound too incredibly bad. I've got the Yeti mic going now. We're hoping the internet connection doesn't make this sound too laggy. But there's a lot that I know people want us to get into, Mr. House. I mean, we've seen both multiple Gopher football practices. And I think there's a lot of people that want to know, first and foremost, and I suppose we have to start with maybe the most important position in football, the quarterback one. Mm-hmm. And if I've learned anything, because I put out Tanner Morgan's quotes yesterday, and of course, my Twitter mentions immediately go into a dumpster fire of Tanner Morgan's the worst thing to ever happen to this world since something in like the 1940s. And it's like, I don't think fans truly understand that. Well, here's the other part, House. It immediately goes to, well, the media will just never say it. It's the media to blame. Now, what I want to pose to you, House, and then we can get into what we've kind of seen from Tanner and the rest of the quarterbacks here this spring is EPA. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, if you were going to explain EPA to someone who doesn't know anything about maybe advanced analytics in football, why do you love EPA so much and what is it?
Expected points is just the best way to evaluate football performance because, for example, in simplest terms, when you're looking at a specific play and it's second and 10 and you get 5 yards, the box score is going to just put 5 yards in there. Where if you get 5 yards on second and five, it's much more valuable. It also takes into account field position, moving the chains, all the things that you really want to factor in to determine success rather than just looking at context. You know, it gives you context versus looking at just sole yards. It tells you how high leverage the play was, how explosive it was, where it was located on the field. All of those key variables come together to basically paint a clear picture, which is what I always say analytics do, you know, advanced stats, numbers, information. I think people always view it like analytics is all numbers, but really it's football research. It's painting the picture of the game in a way that you can understand how everything came together to determine a decision you made, a play that defined the game, how you created a mismatch for a player. Was it effective? Was it not? Combining football instinct with the numbers and scheme and all of that is the key to success. So EPA basically takes into account all the key factors and limits looking at a box score and going, man, this guy, you know, threw for 250 yards. Well, what did he, was he able to move the chains? Was it a high leverage play that pushed you deep into opponent territory? It gives you the context that's needed to assess performance.
I guess the short answer to I'm looking for is EPA the best stat for trying to evaluate quarterback performance versus something like, say, QBR, in your opinion?
I like it better because you can add context to it by looking at success rates, determining, you know, how efficient you were on early downs, because I feel like first and second down is extremely important because you want to stay on schedule offensively. And also the EPA component takes into account how explosive you are if you're creating explosive plays, but also the success rate accounts for, you know, are you keeping the drive alive? Are you staying ahead of the sticks? You're not getting put behind the sticks and then the pass rush can take over. So I'm blending a lot of things together when I'm looking at football performance, and EPA is just one version of it. It's a measure of efficiency with context. And then you compare other variables up that with that to paint a clear picture. That's what it comes down to. The coaches, the players, everybody involved with the team, they're looking at that canvas, man, and they have the opportunity to be creative and paint a picture every single time, because each game, each decision is different. So it's important to have that context and then viewpoints that blend football schematics and the numbers together.
Well, it's funny, we talk EPA. It's not like I didn't bring it up for a reason. In front of me, I have the EPA of every quarterback in the FBS last year. Mm-hmm. So all 130 FBS teams. Now, I wanted to tell you in the pre-production meeting where Tanner was, but I think it would be good for you to guess. So of the 130 quarterbacks that played FBS football last year, where do you think Tanner Morgan ranked in just straight EPA added, or I guess subtracted from his team?
Probably in the 80s somewhere, 80s, 70s.
He was number 57 in the country. So he was an above average quarterback via EPA last year.
But does that include non-conference or just looking at the Big Ten games?
That is looking at just the regular season.
Okay, regular season.
So, yeah, so it would include the non-conference, does not include the bowl game. I don't know if Parker put one out after the bowl games. Now, to give context here, folks, can you guess who are in the bottom 15? How many Big Ten West quarterbacks are in the bottom 15?
Oh, for sure. Spencer Petras is way down there.
Graham Mertz is number 121, minus 29.
Yep.
Spencer Petras, number 122 in the country. Minus 32. You've also got guys like Ryan Helinski, the Northwestern quarterback. Michael Penix, minus 35, one of the worst quarterbacks in the entire country there as well. So, I mean, I think the point I'm just trying to make here is I don't know that you and I think that Tanner Morgan is the greatest thing since sliced bread. But I think the context is needed to also say that Tanner Morgan is an average quarterback, and that's incredibly okay to be an average quarterback in the Big Ten West, because even with all the issues last year, whether it was wide receiver play, whether it was inconsistency blocking up front, whether it was Mike Sanford calling plays that maybe he had no business trying to figure out what the identity of an offense was, and yeah, Tanner had issues as well, but even with all those issues last year, House, Tanner still ranked 57th in EPA. And again, I don't pretend to be a Tanner apologist, contrary to maybe what some of the people listening to this think I am. It's just more so of me trying to say, House, do you agree or disagree with the statement that if we had to rank the four things that I would say went wrong most with the passing game last year, and that is wide receiver play, that's Tanner Morgan, that's Mike Sanford, and then that's the inconsistency that was pass protection up front, how would you necessarily rank those? Because again, you and I have asked a lot of questions about the passing game, to the point where Tanner even said when we were at the last practice, yeah, I get it, the entire state of Minnesota wants to know about the passing game. But if the whole passing game is going to take a step forward, we have to look back. And so when you look at last year's passing game, how would you rank those four things from least important to most important about why the passing game was what it was last year?
Context, man, it's very important. There's so many different layers to evaluating offensive performance. It's route concepts, it's the details, it's coming out of the break at the right time, it's making sure that the timing of the passing game is in perfect sync, not running longer, developing routes consistently, having the quick game married up with, you know, the vertical passing game, and being able to layer your passing concepts from RPO to play action to drop back passing. And those things help a quarterback be very successful within the environment that they're working in. I feel as if Tanner Morgan has a ton of potential with Kirk Ciarrocca coming back, because he's going to play to his strengths. And that's something that I've been really assessing lately, is going, okay, what does Tanner Morgan do best? Very underrated as a play action passer, and the data will actually tell you he's super effective as a play action passer. So how can you incorporate that in and marry that up with the running game? Because you have the outside, the inside zone, a pretty diverse rushing scheme that allows you to do some different things. You see wave now of the power read RPO, which Alabama made very popular. I could see that being something that Minnesota tries to implement? What does the play action game look like to just marry up the RPO game with everything else? Because you come to a point where, you know, if you're able to run RPO effectively, you're going to get people playing man coverage against you. You'll have people sitting on those routes. You'll have a safety possibly robbing in the box. Well, when that happens, you got to run crossing routes. You got to get guys moving across the field, stair-stepping in a sense, so you can create opportunities where you're putting your speed against their speed and getting open consistently. And maybe that's by, you know, manipulating the coverage by, you know, using a throwback or setting up rubs or different things like that. But Tanner Morgan has the elite trait in terms of the leadership ability, the preparation, the ability to like rally his teammates around. And honestly, I think that's one of the most underrated traits of being a successful quarterback is how do your teammates respond to you? And everybody stuck with Tanner last year. I mean, like you said, there are a lot of variables at play. The offensive scheme, how teams are playing you, the pass protection, the details just weren't there in the passing game. And also there are ways through, you know, looking at it from a, you know, big picture through a different lens that you can possibly make some offensive changes from a tendency perspective, setting yourself up so you're not behind the sticks as much, becoming more balanced offensively. Those types of things are all contributing factors. There are a lot of things I believe that can be implemented to maximize Tanner Morgan's potential and really take him to another level. His experience is extremely valuable. I mean, he's been through a lot of stuff. I mean, last year was a unique year in a sense for him personally too. I mean, there's a lot going on. And so I think fans should be excited about Kirk Ciarrocca and what could possibly happen with the offense, because he will suit the scheme to the strength of the players.
And that's where we can kind of get into now what we've seen from Tanner this spring. And that's where I would say the biggest thing I've noticed is, I think you would agree with me, or I guess, would you agree with me if I said Tanner Morgan needs the offense to operate in the black and white, because that's where he lives and that's where his strengths are. It's where the gray area of quarterback play, say when something breaks down, is where maybe he gets a little happy feet, you know, things don't go well for him. And that's where I think the biggest thing I've noticed is Tanner knows what's going on in this offense. Like Tanner, well, yes, you can say yes, because he had 3 years of it with Kirk Ciarrocca before he left for two. But like, he knows what read one, read two, and read three is. And then if you just know what the coverages are, it's going to go a lot better for someone like Tanner. So before I kind of get into what I've seen from Tanner this spring, what have you thought so far through three practices open to the media?
I just feel like he's super comfortable. He's relaxed. He's playing his game. That's half the battle, is having a coach back like Ciarrocca, who he knows everything that he wants him to do, technique wise, fundamental wise. And just watching Ciarrocca and the amount of detail that he just emphasizes every single practice, like, you know, making sure receivers run and route at the right depth, or you know, making sure that the quarterback is thrown with sound mechanics on each throw, and, you know, getting to the top of the drop and making sure that the ball's getting out where it needs to and making the right read and all of those things. You can tell that there's a significant amount of hands-on coaching, because last year the passing game was just too inconsistent. I mean, it was a variety of factors where on a play-to-play basis, the things that were going wrong, you know, one play might have been a scheme decision. The other play might have been somebody gets totally beat blocking up front. You know, they didn't handle movement of stunts well, which I think will be a lot better with a more athletic tackle spot. Some of the personnel they have there, some of it was related to, you know, receivers not being detailed in their route running. Other things were, you know, maybe running the ball, skewing toward running the ball a little bit more. So teams were able to defend you pretty easily and understand exactly kind of what the tendencies were going to be. And then you get behind the sticks and the pass rush tees off, and there you are. So what you got to be able to do, and after watching spring practices a little bit, I'm going, okay, I look at this personnel and I say, all right, get the quick game going, blend that up with the RPO, use Tanner Morgan's strengths as a play action passer to stretch the field. That's what you saw in 2019, was a balanced multidimensional attack. You want to make the defense think, okay, how am I going to defend Minnesota? Do I want to bring an extra defender into the box to try to stop the run, which then, you know, you're going to be short on coverage resources and you're able to attack vertically and all those things tied together. It's, I've said it earlier, but it's all one big painted picture and everybody contributes to it. And you have to have everybody on the same page and going the same direction. And I think, you know, that's pretty apparent to me through spring practices is that everybody is on the same page. Now it's, you know, getting the offense implemented, suiting it to the strengths of the players and finding ways to maximize potential.
Yes, I think Tanner has looked comfortable. I think if you were one of the fans who went to the two open practices mm-hmm. for the public, I think you've seen that too. I don't know that I've seen Tanner throw a pick yet. And it's not like he's, you know, Donovan McNabb in his time as a Viking quarterback where he's captain check down or, I mean, he's throwing the ball down the field. So I think all this is, I'm just trying to say, like, I think we're going to see something a lot closer to 2019 than what we saw the last two seasons, just because I think the offense is going to be tailored to his skill set more and especially what the offense wants to do overall. But I also think people think that Ethan Calley-McManus is already ready. And I think you and I would both agree that I don't know that there's any doubt that Ethan may be the most physically talented quarterback in that room, whether it's, you know, the measurables of height and weight, whether it's the arm strength, whether it's just the athleticism. But I think you know where I'm going to go with this. How would you evaluate Ethan Calley-McManus's consistency from maybe series to series, rep to rep, or practice to practice for a second-year quarterback?
I thought he made significant progress from the last time I saw him, which was a while ago. And one of the things that I have said before about developing quarterbacks is when you first get him in, there's going to be a lot of lows, a lot of inconsistencies, mistakes, the game, trying to process, you know, the coverages you're seeing, making sure you're getting players in the right spot, learning the terminology, all of those things involved with being a quarterback. And you got to remember that Kirk Ciarrocca wanted Ethan. He was recruiting him. He had a relationship with him. He felt like he would fit well in what he was trying to do offensively. So, you know, you look at where he was even a year ago, just, you know, there was a lot of moments where you're going, this thing is moving too fast. Now I see a lot of solid reps where it's like, okay, he read the defense. He anticipated through the, that's the key. Throwing with anticipation is one of the most important things that you're going to develop over time as a quarterback. And I feel like he's starting to get to that point. Mechanically, not as long of a throwing motion, looks more compact in that sense. So his accuracy has improved. Not as many balls that sail or go high. You know, there are certain reps where you see, you know, he needs to continue to work on mechanics and processing and all that, but that's to be expected. Maybe it's, you know, two quality reps and one rep where he doesn't hit the mark. So to see that progression and his comfort level seem to get a little bit better, just think about where he'll be after another year working under Tanner with Kirk Ciarrocca. I feel like his progression is moving along, but we'll see. I mean, it's a long time, a long process in developing quarterbacks.
Is. And that's where, even from what we saw last fall to what we've even seen here from, I don't remember what spring practice we were at to, you know, the 2-3 we've seen, he's getting more consistent. Now, there's a lot of room to still improve there. And I still think that, you know, Ethan should probably be considered the front runner for the 2023 quarterback job. I think, you know, God forbid Tanner goes down this year. It'd be interesting to see what Kirk Ciarrocca would do. You know, would you go to Cole Kramer, someone that has been here, you know, quite a bit, maybe has a higher floor for what this offense would be in 2022 versus what Ethan could potentially provide as a higher ceiling, but he also would be more turnover prone more than likely. So I think either way, I think we both agree at quarterback that Tanner's the guy for 22, and it's looking more like we're going to see the 2019-ish version. Now, again, I don't want people to say that's what we're saying. Tanner's better throw 30 touchdowns with 7 picks, but you know, it looks more like the 2019 offense because Kirk Ciarrocca's back. Tanner Morgan looks a lot more comfortable in this offense than he did maybe a year ago. But I also think there's reasons for optimism that next year with Ethan Calley-McManus potentially, and we'll see what happens when Jacob Knuth gets in here as well, that you might see the quarterback actually take the ball 3 to 5 times a game for, you know, three carries for 17 yards and a couple first downs, which would add a much needed dimension of this offense. But that also kind of brings me to running back, where it's interesting watching things right now, because we are seeing Mo Ibrahim out there running around, but he's not taking contact. Yep. We are seeing Treyson Potts out there, not cleared for contact yet. I still think it's amazing that he's even playing after spending 5 nights in the hospital after that Purdue game. You've also got Bryce Williams getting reps off that broken leg. We've seen Zach Evans now a lot more without Bucky Irving in that room. So from what you've seen from the running backs, do you have any concerns without Kai or Bucky in this room for 22?
I was already excited about Zach Evans, and everybody who reads the website knows that he was my guy in that last recruiting class, because his film, I just thought, was outstanding. I watched some games online live, and I'm like, this dude's acceleration and contact balance are outstanding. And then when I saw him in person, he just has this natural feel for finding creases, and he waits for the blockers to set up and just can make that last second cutback that is pivotal. There was a toss play in one of the practices where Nick Calrup like laid out Donald Willis, and it was such a good rep. And then he just cuts back on a dime in the middle of the field. And I'm like, okay, I definitely see you. There was a red zone rep where he bounced it outside and hit to the corner. I was like, okay, this dude has checked all the boxes that I need to see. I honestly think he's even ahead of where I thought he would be. So that's probably good news for everybody involved.
Yeah. And that's where I was able to sit down with Kenny Burns last week and kind of go guy by guy in his room. And if you want to read those are free to read on GopherIllustrated.com. But I think he'd probably agree with you that Zach Evans being ahead is probably an understatement. I think I would also say that the staff would tell you, if Zach Evans didn't have the knee injury that he had at the tail end of his junior year, that he tore his knee in some capacity, that I don't know that he's at Minnesota right now, because it's tough to get a 6A running back from the state of Texas who put up the gaudy numbers at a Rockwell high school like he did. And I think if something happens where Minnesota has the angry running back god really angry with them again this year, or just injury Armageddon, I think Zach Evans can provide something as a true freshman. So I think I agree with you that you're going to see Mo for 20 carries. And I think, I mean, what have you thought about Mo? Because we are just 7 months removed from Mo Ibrahim tearing in his Achilles. And that's where, you know, like I do, you know, historically an Achilles injury for a running back hasn't been great. But I think maybe what you can speak to is Mo's game isn't necessarily based upon quick twitch to an extent, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. What have you thought about Mo from what you've seen in individual and the limited reps that he's gotten this spring?
I mean, it's early. I mean, there's still a long way to go, but I don't doubt Mo one bit. I mean, just hearing about him from other people and just learning how he approaches everything, there is absolutely no way anybody should be doubting Mo's comeback, because this dude attacked rehab extremely hard and has put himself in a position to come back and really have success. I mean, you look at Achilles, for example, Cam Akers coming back like he did from it. If you do the rehab the right way and you commit yourself to it, it's possible to come back and play at a really high level. And I look at the running backs. I know a lot of people looked at Achilles injuries and went, well, none of these guys panned out after having an Achilles injury. But there was really no elite back within that group of players that suffered an injury like that. So I feel like he'll be just fine. And the advances in that side of, you know, recovery and surgery and all of those things, and Mo's mindset, he'll be just fine. I'm very excited about the idea that having Mo in the backfield, Bell back, you got Tanner under center, you know, just having that core, and John Michael Schmitz at center, you have leadership all over the offensive side of the ball. And I said it earlier, I'll say it again, having Kirk Sciacca back and being able to turn the dials and suit the scheme to the strengths of the players is the biggest thing that has to happen. You got to find ways. The best coaches maximize their talent and put them in the best positions to be successful. And mm-hmm. I'm expecting a big leap forward. There are a lot of things that they can do that I believe could take their offense to another level. And now I'm just fascinated to see if some of those things come to fruition in the next few months when we get into fall ball practices and then the season's here.
I had to get you to prognosticate about how you would divvy touches in this room. Now, I asked Kenny Burns that question. He wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole, and I get it. So I think what I would do is 17 to 20 touches for Mo,
mm-hmm.
10 to 13 touches for Trey Potts. Bryce Williams is your third down back.
Yeah.
Where do we differ?
I would blend in Zach Evans just a little bit, but it would be.
I just would hate to burn the red shirt for like five touches a game. Now, I think we're also in the day and age now, I think that we've seen that in the transfer portal era, is there a point to red shirting? Because it just kind of is what it is. But like, if you're going to open the Zach Evans bottle, because all I have is flashbacks to before your time, when you were still just a glimmer in your father's eye, when David Cobb burned his red shirt for like a meaningless snap in a blowout game on the road somewhere. I forget where it was, but I get why you would want to have Zach Evans. Look, I think Zach Evans has looked really good too, especially for a true freshman trying to assimilate into an offense. It's just, I want Mo to get his touches because I know Mo's gone after this year. If Trayson Potts, if and when he gets cleared, because it sounds like it's not necessarily an if, but when at this point, I want him to have, you know, the ball in his hands, because I know that he did good things in his four game stretch before going down. It's just trying to find touches for everybody in that room is a great problem to have for Kenny Burns.
Yeah. And my logic behind it is Zach Evans is talent. If he's ready to play, you get him out on the field, because this is the year where you have all your weapons. You have the veteran experience coming back on offense. If he can give you an edge as a complement to Mo, then you're finding a way to get him on the field. And I don't think the staff will have any issue if he shows that he's ready to go and they can drop some packages for him that suit his strengths and get him involved. I don't think in this era, things have changed so much, like you said, with the transfer portal and NIL and all those variables, that if a player is ready to go, I probably would have had maybe a different opinion if Bucky was still here. But with the idea that there's opportunities and you know, seeing him in spring ball and getting a feel for where he's at and already feeling really good about his film. And keep in mind, he played against extremely competitive
6A Texas football is as good as any football in the entire country. And that's peace and love to everything down in Florida or in Georgia.
It's a different beast. And that's the deal, is he has that experience. So that has helped his transition a little bit. So I'm not as afraid of that, because it's much easier to build your roster. If someone leaves early, it means they're playing extremely well. And that's a good sign for your team. So you can hit the portal, find a back, you can plan ahead. There are a lot of options, more so than before, where, you know, if you burn a red shirt like that, it affects your planning for the 4-year process. But now with the portal, if a player is ready, get him out on the field. That's my mentality.
So let's transition to wide receiver now. And I think maybe the most interesting thing is whether from talking to Shiraka, Tanner Morgan, Chris Ottman Bell. And I think the Chris Ottman Bell quote kind of maybe sums it up. Everybody wants to know about Dalen Wright. And I get it, because you come to a practice, Dalen Wright is going to be the first thing that you notice. Number 5 for the receiving core, mm-hmm. flash last year. And do you remember the quote that Chris Ottman Bell gave you when you asked a few days ago about what strides has Dalen Wright made? Essentially, you don't have to say it verbatim, but what would the Cliff Note version of that be? Because it's kind of been the theme here, whoever you talk to.
Basically just buying into the details and grinding it out in the film room, executing the details that he needs to take his game to another level. Just that next step of buy-in is the thing that I would say everybody has been saying when you ask about Dalen Wright. I mean, you watch him practice, immediate jump out, and people forget the big plays he made, like the Ohio State game, that Wisconsin catch, the body control along the sideline there, that game might have looked totally different if he doesn't make that play. So the flashes are there, but when this thing clicks together and he understands like all of the things that are needed to play the position at a high level, and he buys in, works hard, commits himself to it, he has an incredibly high ceiling, like one of the higher ceilings of receivers that the Gophers have had recently, just off sheer ability. So what happens when all of this comes together? That's what I'm interested to see, because the Gophers need him to take that step forward. That is a major X factor for this season. If Dalen Wright can become a primary, you know, option, a dynamic complement to Chris Ottman-Bell.
So the verbatim quote from Chris Ottman-Bell to the Daniel House question of what strides have you noticed from Dalen Wright this spring is, he's actually putting in the work to get better. So there were a lot of things, like I'm sure you've written about, I've written about, I've discussed it. Like Dalen Wright had his best friend die. He was the Utah football player, got shot out in, I think, late September, early October, knocked him out for like 3-4 games as he went to the funeral, was grieving quite a bit. And obviously the consistency wasn't there. And I think a large part of that was because of what he went through. And maybe just growing up a little bit too. And that's where, even from talking with Matt Simon about him, it was, you know, he referred to him as a true freshman. And I went, wasn't he? He was a third year player last year. He goes, well, he didn't really play at A&M. So this was his first, you know, year on the field, first year with us. And there were a lot of growing pains. And he would even tell you, like, they're still going through those growing pains here this spring. But to your point, and I agree, there is no player that can elevate this offense more than what Dalen Wright can do. Now it's just getting him to be there, to be more consistent, to work on the details. And even Chris Ottman-Bell said, you know, the other day he walked in on him and Tanner in the meeting room at 7 a.m. on like a Monday. Mm-hmm. Like he's putting in the effort to get there, which again, we can control two, you know, a lot of things in life, but the two that maybe make sense to me the most are your energy and your effort. Well, you're seeing the energy and the effort by Dalen Wright going into it now in 22. And if they can just even get, house, I don't know, 70% of what his ceiling could be, I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, Chris Ottman-Bell also said he has a chance to be better than Bateman. And I agree. It's just, I don't, like, people also have to realize it is an incredibly lofty ceiling for him. But it's also a very middling floor, where it happens to result in a 25% snap share like we saw last year. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how he kind of continues to get better over the next 4 months. But I think people also want to know about guys like Daniel Jackson and Michael Brown Stevens' house, where, you know, Daniel Jackson played a lot of snaps last year. You know, he was got a 77% of his snaps last year came from the slot. You also had Michael Brown Stevens, the A-dot God, where all Michael Brown Stevens was essentially used for last year was deep shots. Highest average depth of target on the entire Gopher football team. Again, you don't know what average depth of target is. How far down the field is, you know, is his target? So I think Michael Brown Stevens was like an average of 16 yards down the field per target. What have you seen from two guys who, well, again, inconsistent last year as they were, you know, really getting there, trying to get established? What have you seen so far from MBS and Daniel Jackson?
You look at their skill sets and you have to ask yourself, what do they do well? And that's what Kirk Schrock is doing with every single player on the offensive side of the ball. He's going, okay, spring ball, I'm going to use as an opportunity to understand what my guys can and can't do. And then I'm going to get into the laboratory and build the scheme even more around what those guys do best. And when I look at Daniel Jackson, I see someone who in the intermediate game gets open at the top of routes. He runs, he's a good route runner, but like it's the consistency side of it. It's like when he comes out of the break, it's like making sure that the route, you know, he's finishing the route correctly, break foot, drive foot, line foot, and then the ball's there, you know, catching the ball consistently. That was something that he struggled with a little bit last year. But I know people kind of roll their eyes a little bit, but it's like PJ talking about the lack of continuity and people moving in and out and all that last year. It plays a huge role. I mean, it hurts the quarterback as well, because when you have receivers coming in and you're trying to figure out the timing of how they run routes and their style and what they do, you know, how they're going to come out of a break, when, where the ball needs to be, those types of things. It impacts the whole passing game. And I felt like last year, it was just the offense lacked flow. And some of that was due to play sequencing. Some of that was due to how the defenses were playing, how Minnesota was, you know, responding to that. So Daniel Jackson needs to get the ball in the intermediate game, maximize some of the yards after the catch ability, get him opportunities to make plays in that capacity. And there are a lot of different ways that you can suit the scheme to Daniel Jackson, which is some stuff that I've been particularly diving into. So I feel like his upside's there. We saw flashes. Now it's all putting it together. And then Mike Brown-Stevens is someone who needs to be used more in space. Get him the ball in space. Let him create. Get him into the screen game, tunnels, bubbles, those types of things. Let him run the intermediate routes, the RPO game. Get him into that as well. Less vertical attack, more underneath. But then also when teams are sitting on those underneath, he definitely has the speed to take over the top. So trying not to emphasize throwing the ball vertically as much to Mike Brown-Stevens, but getting him going and getting him confident in a rhythm underneath is key. And a lot of times last year too, you know, we talk about the passing game. It was just, you know, they go away from the passing game, like a drop pass or, you know, route that wasn't run correctly or a little
bit. And I totally believe, like I'm sure you do, that was Fleck. Like, for as much shade as we can throw at Mike Sanford, I get it. Like, I fully believe that was a whole PJ Fleck getting in the headset saying, you know, F the passing game. I'm so angry with them. And obviously it didn't help the entire offense in spurts last year.
Yeah, it's a factor, and the offensive flow is a huge part of being successful on that side of the ball. You got to be in a rhythm. You got to stay ahead of the schedule. You got to put your offense in a position where the defense doesn't know what you're going to do. Predictability is when you get into trouble offensively. Got to be able to get into the short yardage situations and have the play action game work, get defenses guessing. There's just so much you can do. I love the potential that is available. I'm just wondering how it's all going to come together. I'd like to see them get one speed-oriented receiver in here that maybe can provide some value in that area, maybe take the top off defenses. I'm wondering, like, where is Christian Hoskins going to be at when he gets here? That's one player I'm very excited to see once he arrives. But yet again, you know, the strength is you got Brevin Span Ford. You can design some packages for him. So there's targets there. So Rock has options offensively. It's just how he wants to turn the dials.
So I laughed at your comment about trying to get another receiver in here, because I think maybe the biggest argument I've been having with the lovely people of GopherIllustrated.com, which, oh, by the way, it's $1 for 30 days, or we got a sale coming up right before the spring game. And we'll let House get in his plugs here at the end of the episode. But the biggest argument I've been having with them is, like, you look at the first four receivers and then you look at whoever wide receiver five is. There is not a bigger drop off than the wide receiver one group to the wide receiver two group. Like, from the ones to the twos, I would argue there's no bigger drop off from ones to twos on the entire Gopher team than at wide receiver. And, you know, I'd love for Minnesota to explore it in the transfer portal as well, because I think you could find somebody. But in that same breath, I think I would be told, if I asked, you know, some of the sources, that how are you going to sell them come in and be the wide receiver five? Because right, you got four guys that they really like, you know, and you also threw the ball the least amount of any power five team. And that's all people, again, that's all people will see. So it's an interesting place to be in that wide receiver room after the top four, because I think we both agree we like Ike White, the true freshman that early enrolled. You know, I know that they like Lamecki Brockington. I just have no opinion on Lamecki Brockington because I haven't seen Lamecki Brockington.
Well, that's just
be it. Healthy. And like I told you last practice, the best ability in football is availability. And we'll get to that with JJ Gaudet on the offensive line, but it's just like
Brockington has that ability though. Like, I saw,
when was the last time you saw it? In the fall.
Yeah. There were some good flashes in the fall, but
right. And like, I remember being at those practices with you. It's just, I want to see it. Like, I hate making statements or opinions based on things I saw 7 months ago.
Well, and that's just it. Like that's where the coaching staff, they're seeing it every day. They have a feel for what the personnel looks like. But if they can get one player to step up that's got a speed-oriented skill set that can put some stress on defenses, whether that's Lamecki Brockington, that's Christian Hoskins, whoever it is, that's the next step for me with this offense, is getting kind of a Swiss Army knife type of player that can be used very creatively in the offensive scheme to create some mismatches.
All right. So let's talk a little tight end before we get to offensive line. Everybody listening to this podcast knows my love and affinity for hopefully using Brevin Spanford in the passing game. For you, as someone who's maybe a little bit more unbiased, what have you seen from Brevin here in spring ball? Do you think year five is finally the year where Brevin Spanford can get five targets a game in an offense?
Yes. And I believe that will be a component of the offensive scheme that Shiraka for sure wants to get implemented. He didn't have that type of skill set, that potential the first time he was here. It was still developing. Now with Brevin being at the point he is, it's all about consistency there. Like, being a really good run blocker, such an important component of being successful within this scheme. And that's something that Minnesota's made clear. Like, if you're going to play tight end in this offense, you have to be able to block. And Brevin has made strides in that area. Now it's all about consistencies and also finding ways that you can get him involved into the passing concepts. If you can do that, then you add another element that defenses have to worry about. I mean, this guy stretching the seam, you know, getting him on safeties and linebackers, and it creates another dimension. So, you know, that's some of the stuff that I'm excited about offensively. I keep saying it, but I feel like Shiraka, with the experiences he had at West Virginia, some of the things that they did there, that really could fit nicely, some of those things into Minnesota's offense.
All right, let's talk a little offensive line, where you have the Remington candidate, John Michael Schmitz. And then you have a lot of, maybe inexperience isn't the right word, because there is experience in spots. But what I want to ask you about first is the spot I'm most worried about on this entire offense right now, and that's right tackle. Where, yeah. I mean, I could make the argument, and I think I have on Gopher Illustrated, like there may not be a player who could not afford an injury this spring more than J.J. Gaudet. The fourth year was projected to be the starter at right tackle. He's been waiting his turn patiently behind Daniel Faalele, and now he hasn't practiced at a single one. And oh, by the way, Quinn Carroll, who was just there last weekend, graduates from Notre Dame here in the coming weeks, and he'll be here in a month. So maybe this right tackle thing will just sort itself out if Gaudet is healthy at some point before fall camp, and then you get Quinn Carroll in as well. But Martez Lewis and Tyrell Lawrence at right tackle is clearly, to me, the weak link right now on the offensive line. So do you think I'm just overblowing this entire thing? Do you think there is some merit to the right tackle discussion? Because I don't know what to think, because I think the two candidates that will be competing there in fall camp are J.J. Gaudet, if he's healthy, and then Quinn Carroll. But we don't know, is Quinn Carroll a tackle or is Quinn Carroll a guard? I have no idea. So how do you feel about right tackle, knowing your four options there right now?
I would say it's a question mark. I wouldn't say I'm like worried about the position in a sense. Well,
what other position or what other of the starting 11 on offense would you be more worried about right now than right tackle?
It'd probably be that depth spot receiver, the depth spots at receiver. That would be, because I just don't know how those players are going to develop. Although I think you can scheme to suit the strengths and help there, where it's a little less, you know, there's not much you can do. You know, you got to be able to block at right tackle. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So you look at it and you go, okay, J.J. Gaudet unable to practice, but when he comes back, is he going to be ready to play? Like the development side of it, how is that going behind the scenes? We don't know. Like,
and that's where I'm sad for him, because it was just the reps and getting the experience of being the guy now at right tackle. Fourth-year player, you should be there strength-wise, but it was just getting the reps in 15 practices, and now he doesn't even get those.
Well, and Quinn Carroll now, he has to acclimate. from a concept perspective, many of the things that they did out there will help him transition. Okay, I think, but that's part of it. He's got to come in here and get ready. But there's no question that the talent that he has, and Martis Lewis just needs reps. That's what spring ball is for. I can't evaluate O-line, D-line play in the spring. It's just, I mean, you can't really evaluate any position in the spring, but like O-line, D-line is probably the toughest thing to do just because I want to see how they compete in contact periods, you know, when the stakes are high. So I would say right now it's a question mark, but I do feel like depending upon those circumstances that we talked about, they will be okay because I like the athleticism that they have at the tackle spot. I believe that will help them a lot. And I wrote about it. I'm raving about Chuck Filiaga. I believe that.
The Michigan grad transfer they took, who's playing, yeah. I believe, right guard for them right now, right?
He fits really well. Yeah, I already can tell that looks like it will be a very, very good get for the Gophers. He has a chance to be really good.
Well, if you're going to take Chuck Filiaga as your guy, I'm going to take the one that is even easier to take, and that's Ariante Irsary.
Oh, yeah.
The third-year guy who's going to be starting at left tackle for Minnesota, the one that no matter who you talk about, rave about the ceiling, about having a higher one than Daniel Faalele, I think you're a better maybe judge of and can describe his offense or, you know, offensive line stuff, but it's just more so when you watch Ariante Irsary in pass pro, and peace and love to Sam Schluter, but Ariante just makes it look easy. It's fluid. It's athletic. I don't know how he's going to be as a run blocker necessarily compared to Sam, but I'm excited to watch Ariante Irsary this year, because I think from what you're going to get from game one to game 13 is you're going to have some lumps there in September. I'm sure of it, but you're also going to see a ceiling at left tackle like we haven't seen in some time. So what have you liked about Ariante so far?
I said it coming into spring ball, but there is not a player since I've been doing this, that has a higher upside along the offensive line than Ariante.
Why do you say that?
When you watch him block, the trait that I love is he's so flexible. Like when a defensive end is trying to get position, you know, running a speed rush, he's so quick, but then he's able to like torque and get, you know, he's so flexible, mm-hmm. and able to handle the rush. And that directly ties into how his quickness and his agility and his ability to get into the pass set. Like that is the trait that jumps out when I watch Irsary, is he just locks people up because the pass rush, it's all about bend. It's all about being able to get around the corner and have that flexibility. Well, Irsary has the flexibility to match that. And then in the ground game, Burns, what I love about him is he can generate movement. I mean, he establishes leverage. He gets position. He can reach guys. He can get out on the perimeter and work in space. And that creates another dimension for the offense as well. Having the athletic tackles opens up a lot of doors for Minnesota's offensive scheme. So it's the whole package. It's the movement skills. It's the flexibility. It's blossoming technique from a hand, you know, the hand side of it, and that all that. But I mean, it's outstanding athletic ability.
All right. So then that brings us to, you got Ariante at left. You got Axel Rushmeyer in his sixth year at left guard. You have John Michael Schmidt center. You have Chuck Filiaga, and then we'll see what happens at right tackle. I think tackle depth for me is also just, I think, in a spot I wouldn't be opposed to Minnesota exploring here in the next 2 weeks in the portal, where you have Logan Purcell as your number two at left tackle right now. You have Tyrell Lawrence, who at, I would imagine, 380 pounds at right tackle. Now, again, Yadae gets healthy. Quinn Carroll shows he's got the foot speed and athleticism and bend to be a Big Ten tackle. This whole thing becomes negated, but I just want to see it with this offensive line, if that makes sense. They're old enough. I mean, you look at like the two deep house outside of like Logan Purcell, everybody's of the legal drinking age. And that's what it should look like in year six of a Big Ten program. There's a lot of unknown because you have, Ariante's played in one game, one start, and that was 2 years ago as a freshman at Nebraska. Filiaga's had his ups and downs in his Michigan career. You know what you're getting from John Michael Schmitz. Axel Rushmeyer has proved that at least as a sixth offensive lineman, he's really good. Now, can he withstand 550 snaps at left guard? And then we'll see what happens at right tackle. I don't know that I'm one to necessarily doubt Brian Callahan, but it's so more so if you're going to doubt a spot here on the offense, it's probably the one that's replacing four or five starters.
Yeah, and a lot of experience left. But again, it comes back to we're not at practice all that much to be able to see how players are progressing. And also, we're at that point in spring ball where it's really hard to evaluate O-line, D-line play. So I am going to form my opinions on the O-line and the D-line, you know, come once I see like four, you know, fall practices and it's August and I'm getting ready for the season. Like I could tell last season that that was going to be a strength of the team. So when they start getting after it more, that's when I will assess it. But I also feel as if the starting lineup will be fine. It's just, like I said, the unknowns at right tackle, but yet again, the coaches are seeing it every day.
All right, let's switch to defense and try to kind of rush through this one a little bit quicker. Is you mentioned it, it's tough to evaluate O-line, D-line. In spring ball, there isn't really necessarily much, if any, tackling at any of the practices we've really been at. But D-line is a spot where they're replacing a ton of bodies. Sezzi's gone. Boye's gone. Mike Adu Treadway, Niles Pinckney. I mean, you're losing a lot of things up front. So when you look at some of the younger bodies, what have you liked so far this spring?
I was impressed with Devin Eastern. I thought he made significant strides, and we already knew that he was a unique player physically. But and
for people trying to remember who Devin Eastern is, he's the second-year kid from Shakopee, was a four-star defensive lineman, 6'5", probably, what do you think, 295 right now? Mm-hmm. I mean, he is arguably their most powerful defensive tackle.
He is, and that's what you need to be able to push the pocket. Quiet X factor last season for the Gophers defense is the ability to push pockets, constrict escape lanes, make it really difficult on the quarterback. So his physical skill set and dimension in there and his length inside, he's able to extend and get off blocks and also push, you know, interior linemen back into the quarterback, which is huge. And Jacob Schuster, you know, quick feet, first step, good hands. Like that was the thing that always jumped out when you watched his Washington high school film. I mean, it was just he is disruptive. He gets in the backfield a lot. So you have a mix of skill sets. Logan Richter's more of the power skill set. Gage Keys, he can kick in and play three tech. He can play at defensive end as well, being able to, you know, provide value as a pass rusher with his wingspan and lateral quickness. So they have a mix of skill sets and, you know, maybe they'll look to add one more speed oriented defensive tackle before the season starts just as depth. But as things stand right now, I was impressed with Devin Eastern's development in the stuff that I saw and feel like he can, certainly provide value just off sheer physical ability.
Yeah, it's tough not to at least have optimism about the future for, you know, what you're going to get from Trill Carter, and he'll probably lead that room. I'd say snaps. But it's can Devin Eastern take a step in year two? Can Jacob Schuster take a step in year two? Can Gage Keys, someone I think that people mm-hmm. probably aren't talking a lot about, mm-hmm. You know, he's got a ton of reps at the last practice we were at as a three technique. So what have you thought about defensive end? Because, I didn't know that I was going to have to be this, but I'm definitely a Thomas Rush stan where, you know, 2020 wasn't exactly great for him. And I talked to him about it, and you can read that piece on Gopher Illustrated. Just he gets thrown to the fire of switching from linebacker to rush end in 2020. He gets no offseason to do it, misses 2 weeks in fall camp because he's out with COVID. And then, oh, by the way, like 2 days after getting cleared to come back, he's got to line up and play against Michigan. It doesn't go well in 2020, and understandably so. Last year, I think people just don't understand how good Thomas Rush was. I'd say he was better against the run than Boye Mafe was. And oh, by the way, he was second on the team in sacks, pressures, tackles for loss. So I feel good about Thomas Rush there. What have you seen from guys like Austin Booker, Danny Strigow, and then how do you see things playing out at strong side defensive end?
I was very impressed with the strides that Danny Strigow showed, just what I saw from being able to set edges, play confidently in that side of it in the running game. still learning that. And that's something that every young pass rusher faces, but you know, you can definitely see that background of getting leverage as a wrestler and using the hand technique to defeat blocks. So like the developmental potential of him, and you know, you see that rush end position, and you know, like you mentioned with Thomas Rush, he's made significant strides as well. Like I was super impressed with the strides that I saw just in the short amount of time that I was there, just the detail of rushes and just putting everything together. And like you mentioned with Austin Booker, the biggest thing with him was we already knew he was a supreme athlete. It was like getting physically where he needed to be and just getting a feel for what it's like to play defensive line at this level and blossoming the technique and all that. He's someone who will just, when the light bulb comes on and clicks, he will flash and make an impact. It's just a matter of when that happens. And Minnesota definitely has the ability to get him on the field and use him creatively. At the other strong side spot, Jalen Logan Redding is just a solid football player. Like he will set the edge. He will do his job. He can give you value as a pass rusher. Good length, the wingspan to be able to get off of blocks and also be able to control and set the edge, like I said, which is so important as a part of this defensive scheme. And I'm interested to see Ja Joyner's progression, lots of upside in his game as well. And how is he utilized? It's just, you know, that's the deal. Joe Rossi has a lot of options based upon matchups. So he can really kind of suit the D-line rotation toward the game plan.
Well, I don't know that there's much to say about linebacker right now, just because I think you'd agree with me. There may not be a spot in the entire defense outside of like safety that is tougher to evaluate in three spring practices where maybe there's only been 10, 15 plays of tackling than linebacker. So I know who the bodies are going to be. I know it's going to be Braylon Oliver. I know it's going to be Mariano Sorry-Mary and Cody Lindenberg. And then looks like Lucas Finnessy as well. So you got 2 third-year guys there, and Lindenberg coming off a foot injury. Finnessy continuing his transition from an all-state cornerback at like 6'3", 220 pounds in Wisconsin to now linebacker. Is there really much to say about those guys? Because I don't know that there's really anything I can glean of significance when watching a Gopher football spring practice about the linebackers, because again, they're not tackling. So how do you want me to evaluate it, House?
Well, you have Braylon Oliver back. You got Mariano as a leader, and then being able to blend in skill sets like Lindenberg, who gives you value as a range coverage player and also can give you something as a blitzer as well. And Donald Willis as a sub package downhill blitzing linebacker as well. And Finnessy, you mentioned him being another person who showcases a lot of range and athletic ability at the position, which gives you options to really draw packages that suit the strengths of the linebackers. And that ties right into the defensive backfield. Like this is the fastest defense that the Gophers have had, I would say, overall. The blend of speed and physicality. I wrote about that on the website yesterday, just talking about all the possibilities that Rossi has to, you know, fit the skill sets of the players that he has defensively. I feel as if the defense has so much upside and potential. And with someone like Rossi and his staff scheming things up, I'm looking forward to the defensive side of the ball, just off the sheer idea of speed, versatility, physicality. This should be a fun year to see what Rossi draws up as an X's and O's guy. I'm looking forward to that.
I think the three guys that we may be most excited about on defense are Ryan Stapp, Beanie Bishop, and then Michael Dixon. Now, you know, the exciting part about it is for a guy like Michael Dixon, I mean, we're going to see him kind of used as a rover. Now, I know you're already making NFL comparisons for him, and, you know, you can get into those here in a second, but I think I first want to start with the two new additions there at corner. And you never know how a transfer is going to kind of play out. You know, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad, sometimes it's just okay. I think from what I've seen from Ryan Stapp, if I'm going to make one of these my guy for 2022, and I say that knowing the potential of what a Michael Dixon could look like, I love what I've seen from Ryan Stapp. He's the Abilene Christian transfer. I think Minnesota's hit 2 for 2 on their Abilene Christian transfers. And what have you seen from a guy like Ryan Stapp and Beanie Bishop so far?
The transition quickness, so the ability to backpedal and transition, open up your hips and make a play on the ball. Like, they have the ability to actively make plays on the football by tightly mirroring receivers out of breaks. And that's important because you want to get your hand on the football. And that's something that I've studied a lot while doing advanced stuff, is how does it change the game when defensive backs can simply create a pass breakup or an interception? And those things, you would not believe how that ties into your efficiency as a pass defense. So with two defensive backs like that, with unique movement skills and athletic ability and all the traits you're looking for, it opens a world of possibilities schematically, because you can trust those players to play man coverage, and then you get super creative with your fronts, and it all, the whole defensive picture and puzzle, it ties together. So Joe Rossi mentioned it perfectly the other day, is, you know, every year is different defensively. So you have to be able to adapt based upon the personnel you have. And this group that they have, there are some creative things that they can do. So that's the side of it that fans should be waiting for, is what is Rossi going to do, and the staff in that laboratory, because they have to be excited about some of the skill sets they have.
And it's too bad for a guy like Terrell Smith right now, where, again, I can make an argument, may not be a player on the defensive side of the ball that needed to stay healthy more than Terrell Smith, because with Justin Wally there, with now Ryan Stapp and Beanie Bishop, tee time was going to be expected to compete there, and just hasn't been able to kind of maintain his health there. But I also want to give you the floor on Michael Dixon, because again, if you're going to watch a guy in the spring game coming up here on the 30th, I can assure you the guy that's probably going to stand out to you is the guy playing rover / safety / slot / linebacker, who looks like a linebacker, and number 11, Flip Dixon. You'll remember him. He got the interception in the bowl game down in Arizona, but it looks like Minnesota and Joe Rossi want to be a little bit more creative with him, knowing how athletic his skill set is. So what has impressed you about Michael Dixon so far this spring?
When you have that, a player like that with unique traits, the physicality, the versatility, fits between a couple different position profiles, you get that player on the field. So how will Rossi and the staff do that this season? I don't know, but he attacks the football. Like, his range and his instincts and his feel for the game, it allows him to be around the football a lot. And the pairing of his movement skills with the physicality and ability to make tackles in space. I remember the Iowa game, his first year in 2020, him making a couple of unbelievable tackles on the goal line in space. And I was like, okay, what will Michael Dixon be in a couple of years after development? Now we're starting to see that, where he's at. And with the three safeties that they have, there are a world of possibilities to get everybody on the field. This is the most talented secondary Minnesota's had under Fleck. It, just the athletic ability, the coverage.
No, I'm going to stop you there, because I made that statement too. And I remember the Antoine Winfield secondary back in 2019, and I still will stand by it. If you told me you're going to get 13 games of Ryan Stapp, Beanie Bishop, Justin Wally, Tyler Newbin, Jordan Howden, and then Michael Dixon somehow working in there as well. I mean, I think the secondary is going to be a big part of maybe why Minnesota goes a little bit more man-to-man this spring, or this fall, I should say, and that allows them to get more creative in their blunt and in their blunts. Oh, happy 420, everybody. But it's, you know, their blitzes and their stunts and everything up front. But I think I'd agree with you. I mean, from what I've seen, it's just, I think it could be a fun secondary this fall.
The upside's high, and the teams, like I said, who get their hands on the football, they have a lot of success defensively. So I wrote about it yesterday, just studying other defenses, looking how at Minnesota, how they could apply some different packages to the personnel that they have. It'll be fun. I don't think there's been a higher upside secondary than this group in quite some time. So Rossi and the staff, they'll have a world of possibilities for sure.
All right, so let's talk a little bit Big Ten West before we get out of here. And
yeah,
that's where we don't have official Vegas odds for win over-unders now. I would say that what we're going to use, House, is the overlords at 24/7 put out their win projections for the Big Ten West.
Yeah.
So we're going to start from the lowest to, and we're going to go to the highest, and I'm going to have you take an over under, we'll talk a little bit about each team. And so we have to start with maybe it could be the worst team in the Big Ten, honest to goodness, in 2022, the Northwestern Wildcats.
Oof.
I think here at 24/7, they've got the over under win total set at 3 even. So when you look at Northwestern, it wasn't good for them last season. And I know that we've seen Pat Fitzgerald win the Big Ten West 2 of the last 5 years still. But House, I mean, they lost their best secondary player to Notre Dame, lost a key receiver to Mississippi State. And oh, by the way, their quarterbacks are still terrible. Is there a glimmer for hope that Northwestern can get to a bowl game this fall?
Last year ranked at the bottom of nearly every meaningful offensive efficiency metric, and teams ran the ball all over them. I mean, 125th out of 130 in rush defense EPA per play, quarterback positions a mess. Last year, I couldn't figure out what their offensive identity was because it changed on a week-to-week basis, and that's what happens when you lack skill player talent and then your quarterback room is not very stable. So I don't know. When you're losing Brandon Joseph, I mean, they have A.J. Hampton, Cameron Mitchell, Rod Hurd in the secondary, some guys that can build around in the cornerback room. But losing Joseph, like you said, the linebacker room lost a couple of players there. So Northwestern, it's not looking much better. They haven't done anything to convince me that from a personnel perspective that they'll be better on paper. But once again, it comes down to player development. So Northwestern definitely could be at the bottom of the Big Ten West.
All right. Illinois is the next team we'll talk about. They got them at 6 mm-hmm. wins via the 24/7 projections. Again, an Illinois team that came into Huntington Bank Stadium last year and beat Minnesota in what I think was a very shocking game and appalling game offensively for Minnesota. But when you look at Illinois and what they've done to kind of change around things, how do you see the outlook for them in year two under Brett Bielema?
Well, you got Tommy DeVito transferring in from Syracuse. Arthur Sitkowski is recovering from arm surgery. But you look at the running back room with Chase Brown and Josh McCray, they're definitely going to center around being a physical team. And I know Brett Bielema talked about it last year, wanting his offensive line to be better and have more depth. They picked up 2 JUCO tackles, so they're providing some competition there. Julian Pearl's back, a talented player. He'll play one of the tackle spots, but you know, that's going to be a physical run game oriented team. You stop the run. I mean, the weakness of their squad, when you look at it, is that wide receiver. They don't have a ton of talent at that spot. Isaiah Williams flash, maybe we'll take a step forward, but really there isn't a dynamic weapon that scares me really on that side of the ball. But you know, their pass rush should be decent. Devin Witherspoon back at cornerback, Sidney Brown, who was really impressive last year in the Minnesota game. He's back. So, I mean, they lost Kirby Joseph, but I really like Ryan Walters as a defensive coordinator and think he's an outstanding coach. So they'll be okay defensively. I just think the passing game is what will hold Illinois back, where they might get one dimensional.
Now, what I would say is it's interesting for a schedule perspective. Minnesota has a bye week before they play Illinois this year. And I think we know what Kirk Schrock has done historically off a bye week. But I would also say before Illinois has their homecoming game against Minnesota, the two teams that play before Minnesota, Wisconsin and Iowa. So I will be very curious to kind of see where they're at health-wise after two very physical games. Next team let's talk about is maybe, I don't know if they're the most polarizing team in the West this year, but it's Purdue. Mm-hmm. And I believe Aiden O'Connell is back.
Yes.
All Big Ten quarterback for them. I think without a doubt, he's probably the best quarterback in the Big Ten West. Now, 24/7's overlords have a 6 win total projection for them. And they obviously lose George Karlofkas, then they lose David Bell. They're 2 best players in offense and defense. And I think they're just a little skeptical to see, can they get over that hump? So when you look at Purdue, they're a very interesting team, and I think we're going to learn a lot about them when they open the season the same night as Minnesota, but they have to travel they get Penn State at home to start their season. So when you look at Purdue, what stands out to you?
It's a tough team to project. I agree with what you're saying there, like stability at quarterback with Aiden O'Connell, but you know, you lose David Bell. Is Milton Wright able to step up and kind of become that top target. They brought in Tyrone Tracy, probably more as a gadget guy. Elijah Kanyon, a transfer from Auburn. So they definitely went to this, you know, the portal to fill some skill spots. Pass rusher wise, it sounds like they're going to have a heavy rotation. Kydren Jenkins is the player that I'm keeping an eye on. Definitely has a lot of potential, but you look at him up front, a lot of experience coming back there on the offensive line. So that could be a foundational piece. I mean, Jeff Brohm's just a wild play designer. I've been studying him this offseason and reverse flea flickers and fake flea flickers and all these cool play designs. But you know, you haven't been able to really witness Purdue take that next step. They were killed by the turnover margin last year, made so many timely mistakes at turning the ball over. So if they limit some of those, could they potentially improve their win total a little bit? That's one of the factors that I'm looking at with Purdue, because I believe they have solid personnel. It's just some of those players have been developing behind the scenes. Are they able to take that step forward? Purdue's definitely a question mark, but we'll learn a lot about them in the first few games.
All right. If they're not the most polarizing team, I would argue it's probably the Nebraska Cornhuskers. Mm-hmm. They have yet to put it together, and it's literally do or die for Scott Frost in his could be his final year at Nebraska. They need to make a bowl game without question. Now, the Overlords have the over-under at 6.5 for Nebraska in what is either year 4 or year 5 of the Scott Frost era. And I will still, I won't forget for a long time, if Nebraska up 2 scores in the fourth quarter at home against Iowa, just takes care of business, Minnesota goes to Indianapolis after everything they went through last season. So do you believe that this is the year that Scott Frost can put it together at Nebraska?
Put it this way, I'm excited about their offense. I think Mark Whipple's a really good defensive mind, does a lot of things. Offensive mind, new offensive coordinator, but formationally to create matchups, will use motion. I think you'll see a big difference from their passing attack just from a schematic and philosophy perspective. You can expect more balance. And I'm interested to see how running game mind Scott Frost collides with the passing game mind to Mark Whipple, because the pass rates at Pittsburgh last year was like 56%, always been a balanced or, you know, passing to set up the run type of coordinator. So he's always adapted to his strengths. I think, you know, getting Casey Thompson in to play quarterback, that was by design to try to get someone who could throw the ball at 3 levels and fit the type of scheme that he wants to run. You know, Ramir Johnson, it was an explosive back, but got slowed by injuries, and I think he'll be a good fit in the scheme. They got Trey Palmer coming in from LSU, probably a speedy slot receiver, good returner. Omar Manning playing, you know, a couple of different alignments, moving him inside and out. We don't know what's going on with Xavier Betts. Is he coming back? Is he not? I don't know. That situation is up in the air, but the playmaker side of it, I'm interested to see what Whipple does. Defensively lost, you know, Cam Taylor-Britt, who's one of my draft guys. JoJo Doman, they brought in Omar Brown from Northern Iowa as a cornerback and Tommy Hill from Arizona State. But I think the bread and butter of that team will be up front on the D-line with Garrett Nelson being the centerpiece there. But they're looking at trying to bring in another pass rusher the way it sounds, which I could definitely see. So how does that defense come together? What does the offense look like? There are question marks across Nebraska's roster. But there's definitely intrigue with Whipple coming in for me.
I'll tell you this much. Nebraska, if they're going to hit that bowl eligibility, they better do it before November. They're November, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, Michigan.
Oof, good luck. That will be a brutal stretch.
Well, the next team that it's interesting to kind of see what people think that maybe aren't as focused on the West as maybe we are. Iowa's win total is at 7. Now, I think we both have our 2021 Iowa thoughts about, you know, again, they're the Big Ten West champions. Their offense was absolutely dreadful, but it didn't matter because their special teams were elite and their defense just consistently gave them short fields. Mm-hmm. So another year looks like of Spencer Petras as the quarterback. No Tyler Goodson, no Tyler Linderbaum. They get Riley Moss back in that secondary. What do you think about Iowa? Because I do believe when looking at their schedule here, their crossover games aren't exactly kind. They have Ohio State this year. So They have Ohio State and Michigan on the schedule for their crossovers, where obviously Minnesota doesn't. So when you look at Iowa, what do you think about that 7 number?
It feels like it'll be right at it or around 8. I've learned not to doubt Iowa because they always find a way to develop talent. Like when you look at their roster, for example, the center spot, Tyler Ellsbury's only played 22 snaps last season and played at right tackle. Sounds like he'll be the center. Justin Britt, experienced at right guard, but probably will play left guard, a good run blocker, but not as talented as a pass blocker. And Connor Colby allowed the fourth most pressures on the team. He's projected to play right guard. And the tackle spot last year, you look at Plum and Richmond, they accounted for 30% of Iowa's total pressures. And so the offensive line, I learned that they'll get it figured out, but there are definitely question marks. I didn't think they played nearly as well as people thought they would last year. And some of that ties into the quarterback spot and their offense, but can they get that offense figured out? I mean, in EPA per play, they rank 124th out of 130 teams. Their passing offense was 122nd. Their success rate was 116th. But they really relied upon, like you said, turnovers, special teams, really good pass defense. I mean, they didn't rush the passer super well. They were very low in the advanced metrics just in generating pressure. So with Van Valkenburg out, is Joe Evans able to take that step forward? Do they progress up front on the D-line? That's one of my question marks with Iowa, but they'll find a way. They play complementary football. Even if their offense is letting them down, they just step up on defense or win the field position battle like Kirk Ferentz always does.
All right, so the next one I want to get to here is Wisconsin, and we'll finish out with Minnesota here. But you look at Wisconsin, 9 win total. Minnesota's won 2 of the last 4. I think you could argue they should have won 3 of the last 4 with kind of how that game went down in 2020 in Camp Randall. But I look at this Wisconsin team, and I feel like we know what it's going to be. We know that Jim Leonard's going to have that defense cranking up. I'm curious to see what it looks like without Leo Chanel and Jack Sanborn. They still got Keanu Benton up front, but it's also Graham Mertz still throwing the passes. And as we discussed at the top of the episode here, Graham Mertz was one of the worst quarterbacks in Power 5 football, or just in FBS football last year. And if you can shut down the run, like Minnesota did last year, they become a one-dimensional team. Now, their defense is so good that I don't know that it'll matter, but I look at this Wisconsin team that's got crossover games on the road in Columbus, on the road in East Lansing, and I look at a team that before they host Minnesota to end the year on Thanksgiving weekend has tough road games against Iowa and Nebraska. So when you look at Wisconsin right now, what are you thinking about the Badgers?
I want to see how the offense looks this year. Bobby Engram coming in as the new OC. I don't know how they're planning on, if Paul Chryst is calling the players or Engram. I don't know if they've decided yet, but you look at them last year, their play calling skewed toward running the ball on early downs, and they were 80%+ running the ball on first down and Big Ten play, and it propped them up. They had success doing it. Were able to, you know, get themselves into short yardage situations in second and third down. And that, I said it entering the Minnesota game, first down would define that game, because if you stop the run on first down and get Mertz behind the sticks, he's one of the least efficient passers on passing downs in the country last year and struggled against pressure. So, you know, they actually rank below Northwestern in EPA per play from pass offense perspective, which is mind-boggling to me. So what does that group look like with Jake Ferguson, Danny Davis, Kendrick Pryor, all gone? Chimray DK, is he someone who emerges as a legitimate option? Marcus Allen, Keontez Lewis transferred from UCLA. So they definitely address that position. But on the defensive side, like you said, Leo Chanel, outstanding player who I think will be a great pro. So many coaches will be happy they don't have to scheme against Chanel this year, because he's just a game changer and a game wrecker. Guy that really really was the heartbeat of Wisconsin's offense. And then bringing in Justin Clark from Toledo at cornerback, Jay Shaw, DB from UCLA. I saw Jim Leonard was saying he felt like they maybe needed some assistance at safety. So their defensive backfield is something that I'm watching. Like, is it able to come together and be solid? Because if it isn't, then that changes things a little bit defensively for them, because you know they're going to stop the run, but are they able to defend the pass at a high level? So question marks with Wisconsin, but as we've learned, that they'll figure it out and adapt to their personnel.
All right, last one is the one that people care about the most, and I get it, is Minnesota.
Yeah.
And that's where the Overlords have a 9-win projection on them. And again, you look through the schedule here, you get your first 3 games at home, including the Mike Sanford revenge game, the Jerry Killer revenge game. Then you have to travel on the road to Michigan State. It's going to be a very tough game. Your October is Purdue, bye week, at Illinois, at Penn State, of which, by the way, I've mentioned this before, the Penn State game for the Nittany Lions is sandwiched in between two teams you might have heard of, Ohio State and Michigan. So I will be very curious to see if that's the proverbial trap game before you get into a November to remember of Nebraska, Northwestern, Iowa, and Wisconsin. So look, if you've made it this far, I think House would tell you that, you know, this is a very talented team, and I would agree. I think I would almost make the statement of House, and I understand that this is going on record and everything, that this is probably Fleck's most talented team top to bottom, from starter 1 to starter 22. Now, what that means in terms of wins, I have no idea. I think that 9 number is probably a good number for it, because you have the things like, are you finally going to get over the hump against Iowa? You're 0-5. You get them at home this year. It's senior day. Like, is this finally the year you can find a way to beat Iowa? Because if it is, you'll probably win the West. But you also have the things like we've seen, as this is a slow starting team in September. Are they going to trip up on one of those games against Colorado? You know, can they continue to be a thorn in the side of Purdue? So when you think about that 9 number for Minnesota, I think I would probably take, I would just take the 9 as we currently sit here today, because again, you have tough crossover road games against teams like Michigan State, Penn State. You know, you're on the road at Nebraska too, and Wisconsin. Yeah. But when you hear the 9 number, from what you've seen so far this spring, where are you going? Over, under, or are you taking the 9?
I'm taking right at the 9. Yeah. And I would say the 2 games that will define the season are the first 2 Big Ten games, at Michigan State and home versus Purdue, because those 2 matchups are going to be challenging. I feel like the strengths of those 2 teams, it'll present challenges. How quickly can you get into a groove? Because that's something under PJ Fleck, where it feels like they reach their peak in mid-October, early November. They can't do that this year. They need to come out blazing, get off to a good start, because I feel like the middle of the schedule is where, you know, you're able to kind of find your identity, hit a groove. You got Illinois at Penn State, which will be the Shiraka revenge game.
Yep.
And sandwich in between, like you said, 2 tough games for Penn State. You got Rutgers in there. I mean, there's some intriguing matchups week to week where Minnesota will need to play very well to win these games. And Michigan State is the one that I want to see how their secondary comes together. They have returning talent there. They were one of the worst teams in pass defense efficiency last year. They're able to take a step forward there. We'll see, but you know, the door is wide open. The schedule is favorable for them in many ways, but I also think that there will be some challenging games that they're going to have to execute, as always, at a really high level. But like you said, this roster is talented. It's just a matter of how it all comes together. Staying healthy is such a big component of it. You can't have a ton of injuries, but
right,
as it stands right now, you know, that this team is going to be fun to watch come September.
Again, you may get to the end of this and think we're just looking at it through maroon and gold colored glasses and, you know, drinking the maroon and gold colored Kool-Aid. It's just, I think it's tough to not be excited about what we've seen. I mean, there are things that there are certainly question marks that we've talked about, but to your point, House, this is a team that I think is going to be a lot of fun to watch this fall. And I think
They practice really well. And that's one thing I noted is like there isn't a ton of stoppage where coaches are going, man, like, what are you doing? Or like focusing on effort or attention to detail. Like, it's all fundamental corrections. And that's something that tells you got a team that's focused and dialed in.
Yeah. So a lot of fun, House. People can find your work at gophersguru.com. If they want to become a subscriber, what are they going to be getting with you?
You can check out my work at gophersguru.com. The all-access subscription is $5 a month, and you get access to film breakdowns, advanced analytics, just a whole different perspective in terms of looking at the game and evaluating the roster and things like that. I've developed some stuff that allows me to get some advanced stats that I feel are important and shape the outcome of games. So head over to gophersguru.com.
Well, House, I can't appreciate you enough. I know people are really going to enjoy this stuff. I'm sure we'll have you on, I think, again, and we'll do it in fall camp. And yeah, we'll have Luke play kind of the intermediary, because I know we did the NFL type of draft, which I think you're going to win. We'll see what happens here next. Yeah, shocker, House, the NFL draft guru himself, wins that. But we'll get into some over-unders, some different things like that. But can't appreciate you. Can't say thank you enough, Mr. House.
I appreciate it. Looking forward to fall ball. It'll be here before we know it.
Well, everybody, thanks for listening. And as Daniel House would tell you, go Gophers.